families have about them. So I just want to ask that how our parents should deal with their teenagers. How should be their behavior? I know this is a general question. Inshallah, we will go in details, like how should be they firm or how should be their behavior whenever they have faced any problem with their youth. So can you shed some light about this topic, please?
Yeah, thank you so much for such a beautiful question that every not only I think Muslim, but every person as a parent is challenging the dealing with their teenagers. First of all, maybe we don't know our ignorance. Definitely are killing us as a parent, but because when we see very rebellious and the teenager is not listening to us, or some very obvious change physically, mentally in his behavior. So and mostly, unfortunately, the changes are not suitable with the moods of the parents. So they don't agree and they don't like it. And therefore, they start to blaming them. And sometimes the parents are so shocked, you know, and they say, why? My child was such a nice person. What happened to him?
Suddenly, within you know, one day, his mood is totally different.
Exactly.
His behavior is different.
So it's a big jump.
Yeah.
So a few very common mistakes which we do is, first of all, because we are worried about our teenagers, therefore we start to advise them. You know, we are constantly reminding them. We are constantly guiding them, which is just something very awful for them.
Yeah,
you know, they don't like it.
We talk about according to our own mentality. So according to our own mentality, we like to advise ourselves also sometimes. Yeah.
Yeah.
So because we love them, we want to advise them.
But the constant advice is not healthy at all. And then...
So inshallah, after a short break, we will continue this very interesting topic.
Sure.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Dear listeners, welcome back. So we were discussing a very important issue and you are shedding light upon this very important issue. Please, can you continue?
Yeah, the second thing that if whatever we want to say to our teenagers, you know, whatever we have in our heart and we want to advise them, we are not allowed to be harsh with them. Harshness is not, you know, something what we can say effective for the guidance and for the progress of our teenagers. Look at the hadith. The hadith is so beautiful that at-tajanni rasulul qati'a, like if you are harsh towards your teenagers, you are just cutting the relationship. Qati'a. Yeah, you are just sending this message that I don't want to continue.
Yeah, the relationship,
like
you have spent so much time to build it, yeah, to make it strong, then suddenly you are going to destroy it.
And we as a parent, we need that relationship. That is the bridge. You know, I can convey my wishes, my desires, my dreams towards my teenagers. So how come I'm just cutting it? I want to increase, but I don't know the way. Therefore, I'm taking the wrong way. And the third part, which is very important, is that first of all, I'm advising. Yeah, I'm saying, oh, my son, oh, my daughter, don't do this, don't do that. And this, third one, which again, hadith is beautifully explaining to us that we shouldn't criticize constantly. Yeah. So الإفراد في الملامة يشب نيران اللجاجة. لجاجة يعني the person, the child, the teenager will become very stubborn. Why? Because I'm constantly, you know, criticizing, saying, don't do that. I don't like the way you are choosing your clothes or the way you are choosing your friends, you know, your style and so many things, because everything is changing now. And sometimes we as a parent, we don't like those changes. So we are not allowed to constantly criticize and take objections against our teenagers. Choices.
Definitely, as adults, we also don't like, nobody likes to be criticized.
Yeah.
So our teenagers are very, very sensitive. So it's again time for a short break. Inshallah, we will continue after this short break.
Inshallah.
Imam Ali alayhi salam said, excessive blame causes the fire of obstinacy to flame.
Welcome back. So the criticizing someone, it has its own rules, yeah, and regulations. If you criticize our teenagers, this can destroy their personality, yeah? So can you please continue and tell
us? We are so lucky that we have amazing guidance from a Prophet and Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam. So if you really want to criticize your child with love, first of all, that criticize should be in a moderation. So look at the hadith, إِذَا ذَمَمْتَ فَقْتَصِرْ. Beautiful.
Wow.
You know, if you want to say something, it should be in a very brief way, shortest and to the point. You know, short and sweet. Just say, oh my son, oh my daughter, you know, I don't like this, yeah, this,
wow,
this, because
this
of
is
this,
a very
this
beautiful
reason.
Hadith.
Yeah, within
because
2-3-4
unfortunately,
sentences.
Our parents, especially our mothers, you know, when they start criticizing.
Yeah.
They
big lecture.
Keep speaking. And
unfortunately, they start
never
lecturing.
Ending criticism. Yeah.
Yeah. And then one more beautiful hadith says the second condition for criticizing is that, number one, it should be short. Number two, we should criticize or advise them according to their level of understanding.
Okay.
Yeah, sometimes we go far away and we don't know. Like, for example, if I have 13 years old, yeah, my child, and one is 16. So the one who is in 16, that person has more understanding compared to the
definitely,
13 one.
Yeah.
So the level and the way of advising or criticizing should be according to the level of
teenager. And especially you should know your child's, you know, psychology. According to his nature, according to his qualities, you should criticize. Yeah, because some are very, very sensitive. If you tell them one single sentence of criticism, maybe it will become very, very huge for them, unbearable for them. And for some other teenagers, maybe, you know, a normal criticism is okay for them, yeah?
Beautiful.
So according to their nature.
Yeah, and we have to study and read the psychology of our child and our teenager, definitely. And the third condition for perfect and balanced criticism is that if I'm saying something, yeah, if I have any objection about my teenager's behavior, so I have to just focus about this one, like the current mistake. Usually we go behind, we just open up the history. We say, yeah, you have done this. I remember last year you have done the same thing and you are always careless about this issue and that issue. You know, the way we open up the chapter, that is just killing our teenagers. They don't like it. So we should be very careful. This is a very sensitive issue. When we are opening up our mouth, yeah, for this area of his or her life, then there should be the shortest, the sweetest, the most with justice, you know, adala, i'tidal, and balance. And then also just about the current problem.
Yeah, the main issue with what you are talking about, yeah, not the extra things and with details.
Beautiful, yeah.
Yeah, thank you so much. Dear listeners, you are listening to IRIB English Radio. If you have any question, any comment, please share with us at englishradio@irib.ir. That's again englishradio@irib.ir. And you can follow us on social media at Call of Islam Radio, Call of Islam Radio. And you can visit us on www.parstoday.com. Thank you for joining us. Until next episode, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way. A way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
The political crisis in Libya took a turn for the worse recently, with the Tobruk-based House of Representatives in the country's east choosing former Interior Minister Fathi Bashagha as Prime Minister, while current Prime Minister Abdelhamid Dbeibah has vowed to continue in the post until an election is held.
I will accept no new transitional phase, and we will not step up from our role in the government that we promised the people until an election is held.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, our weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. Now, today we are focusing on the unfolding political crisis in Libya, a country that now has two rival prime ministers. Now, this latest development counters UN efforts to reconcile the divided country. We are asking, will this North African state slide back into a civil war? In the second part of our program, we shall move to neighboring Sudan, where the military regime has continued its brutal crackdown on peaceful protesters, calling for a return to civilian rule. Will the military give in to the demands by the masses? Stay with us as our experts give us their insight.
Libya, one country, two prime ministers. On the 10th of February, the House of Representatives, based in eastern Libya, named former Interior Minister Fathi Bashagha to form a new government replacing incumbent Abdelhamid Dbeibah. The parliament argues that the mandate of Dbeibah's government had expired on the 24th of December when elections were scheduled to be held. Differences amongst Libyan political groups led to the indefinite postponement of the eagerly awaited polls. Dbeibah insists that he will accept no new transitional phase or parallel authority and will hand over power only to an elected government.
The United Nations says it still recognizes Dbeibah as Libya's interim prime minister. He is a spokesman for UN Secretary-General at a news conference.
Yesterday, Ms. Williams met with Prime Minister Abdulmahid Dbeibah to discuss recent developments and the votes taken by the House of Representatives to adopt a constitutional amendment and designate a new prime minister. Ms. Williams reiterated the importance of all actors and institutions to work within the political framework and, above all, to preserve calm on the ground in the interest of Libya's unity and stability.
Now, to discuss the ongoing events in Libya, we contacted Mustafa Feturi, an independent Libyan academic and journalist. Thanks a lot, sir, for your time.
Pleasure to be with you again. Thank you for having me.
Now, Mr. Feturi, Libya now has two prime ministers. Now, was there any legal basis that the Tobruk-based parliament relied on when it elected a new prime minister?
Well, of course, it's considered as a legal process because for several reasons. First of all, Mr. Dbeibah's mandate was about to finish last December when the elections take place. That never happened. The elections did not take place. But many considered his continuation of being a prime minister, a caretaker prime minister, actually, because he lost the vote of confidence last September, as we mentioned earlier. Many considered that to be illegal. He should not be there, even though he is just a caretaker prime minister. That's one thing. The other thing, the parliament has the upper hand in this case, because without the confidence of the parliament, legally speaking, in a democratic process, however broken the process is, the parliament is supposed to be the authority in the country that decides who becomes the prime minister by voting and selection of names, you know, different names, and that's what happened. So it's in terms of being legal or not, I think it's quite legal. It also goes in accordance with the UN brokered agreement between the different Libyan factions that was signed in March last year in Geneva, and that brought in Mr. Selected, actually, through what is known as the Libyan Political Dialogue Forum and meeting in Geneva, that selected Mr. Dbeibah as a prime minister.
Different scenarios are emerging regarding the situation in Libya. One of the most likely scenarios is that the Dbeibah government will continue to work, but Bashagha also establishes a parallel government as he promised upon his appointment by Parliament.
I would like to thank the Government of National Unity, headed by Abdulhamid Dbeibah, who took on the responsibilities during a difficult phase. This is the democracy that ensures a peaceful transition of power, and I am confident that the Government of National Unity will be committed to these democratic principles.
Is there a risk of Libya sliding back to civil war if action is not taken to reconcile the warring factions?
The risk of going back to violence in the country at this time, because of this development, I think it's very minimal. Why? Two reasons. One is the fact that it is not something we have seen before, like the division between east of the country and west of the country. The strongest man in the east of the country who controls power on the ground, Mr. Khalifa Haftar, who leads the Libyan army over there, is supporting the selection of Mr. Bashagha. The second reason, we have to remember that Mr. Bashagha, as well as the current prime minister, acting prime minister, Mr. Dbeibah, are Misratins from the western Libyan city of Misrata, east of Tripoli. And that to see them fighting, actually, if any fight will happen, it will happen either in Tripoli, the capital, over the location of power and the seat of power, or in Misrata, their hometown. And Misratans, social leadership as well as political figures, very unlikely to support this or let it happen.
Libyan Prime Minister Abdulhamid Dbeibah survived an apparent assassination attempt when bullets hit his car on the day a rival prime minister was elected. Now, the failed assassination came as armed groups mobilized more fighters and equipment in the capital over recent weeks amid concern that the political crisis could trigger fighting. Now, Mr. Fituri, do we have indications on who was actually involved in this assassination attempt?
Well, you know, the whole affair about this assassination attempt is very unclear, to say the least. I don't think there is any political motivation behind such an assassination attempt, and it's of course condemned, and it's total terrorism, if you like. But at the same time, having said this, I really doubt if something like this has happened, and if it did happen, I have to emphasize this. It has not been fully investigated, first of all. Second, it's very unlikely that any political party was behind this. And the third, we have to also indicate this fact that he's in Tripoli. And in Tripoli, there are dozens of armed militias. Not all of them are happy with him.
While the politicians tussle for power in Libya, for the common man in the street, the main concern remains the high cost of living. Libya topped the Maghreb countries in the consumer inflation rates during the past year, 2021.
People struggle to make ends meet. The cost of living is obscene. The state's budget is billions, while citizens have no hope whatsoever.
Libya plunged into chaos following the killing of the country's Muammar Gaddafi during a NATO operation. Since the fall of Gaddafi's authoritarian regime, Libya has been plagued by US-instigated violence, chaos, and terrorism. Now, as Europe's natural gas stability appears increasingly fragile due to the crisis in Ukraine, Libya is now seen as one of the supply alternatives. This has resulted in increased foreign meddling in this energy-rich North African country. Libya's political crisis has attracted imperialist and regional powers, specifically the United States, France, and the EU.
Other countries said to be part of the mix in Libya include Arab states of the Persian Gulf, Turkey, and neighboring Egypt, which support opposite ends of power. Now, a last question to you, Mr. Fituri. There have been reports of foreign involvement in Libya over the recent past. Now, are foreign powers involved in the current political stalemate in Libya?
Of course. The main problem in Libya since 2011, 11 years ago, has always been the foreign interference. You have conflicting interests for different countries, and the theater of conflict, if you like, the theater of conflict is Libya. So that has always been there. At the current political impasse, if you like, we have different countries that do not wish to see elections taking place, mainly because they believe whoever is coming might not serve their interests, might not help them help their vision or strategy in the long run in Libya. And there are those who try to spoil the whole thing, so Libya becomes more chaotic and easy to control. The foreign interference, unfortunately, has always been the problem in Libya since 2011.
Thank you very much, Mr. Fituri. As always, it's always great having you in our show. Now, let's take a short break. Our next subject will be on the continued crackdown of peaceful demonstrators in Sudan by the country's military. Stay with us.
Sudan's brutal crackdown.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Sudanese armed forces have continued their brutal crackdown on peaceful demonstrators across the country, demanding an end to the military rule. Protesters also want to see the release of political prisoners and justice for dozens of protesters killed since last year's coup.
These regular mass protests have been held in Sudan since October the 25th coup, led by Army Chief Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, which derailed the country's rocky transition to civilian rule following a 2019 removal of longtime dictator Omar al-Bashir.
A demonstrator speaks here on the demands by the masses in the country.
We here and Sudanese everywhere have come out for the same reason today. We want freedom, peace and justice. We want a complete civilian government without the military. The military should stay in their barracks and focus on the country's security at the borders and not get in governance. No military will rule this country. This country is the country of the people. The government is for the people and the military should be in the barracks.
Now for more on the fragile situation in Sudan, we contacted Julius Mbaluto, an African affairs analyst. Now, at least 80 protesters have been killed by Sudanese security forces since the coup occurred in 2021. It appears the military junta is clinging to power with an iron fist. Mr. Mbaluto, what's your take on this?
We've seen military making different approaches to appease the protest. Of course, we saw their latest move when they tried to free the former prime minister. And then in a minute, they tried to contain him because they signed an agreement with him to carry on with their leadership, but also including him. But he didn't have much say about it, making him ending up in a resign. And of course, since that time, all we have seen in Sudan is just continuous protest. Because, I think Sudanese have come to realize that the military is not serious in terms of changing. They just want to carry on as normal. They want to rule. They kicked off the civilian part of leadership in the coalition, and now it's just the military, basically. So they seem to be very desperate to frustrate all these people until they just accept that rulership.
Relentless protests have rocked Sudan since the military coup last October. Fresh crackdowns on protesters will likely complicate UN efforts to find a way out of the country's crisis. The UN spokesman elaborates here on the ongoing efforts to reconcile warring parties in Sudan.
Turning to Sudan, the first stage of the UN's facilitated consultations for political process on the way forward has concluded. The first stage began on January 8th and brought together a range of groups, including civil society, women's rights groups, political parties, academics, journalists, and others. The Secretary General's Special Representatives in Sudan, Volker Pertz, said he heard a range of perspectives and proposals from the Sudanese people to overcome the current political crisis. He expressed his gratitude for the commitment and enthusiasm of representatives of groups from across Sudan who came to meet with the UN, engage constructively and share their concrete ideas.
Despite the brutal crackdown in Sudan, the masses have continued with their protests, demanding a return to civilian rule. What are the driving forces behind the consistency in these protests?
And these are determined activists who will not let go, and they're also instrumental to the protests globally against hanging on to power of former President Omar Bashir. But you see, they are still the same, you know, they've gone back to Sudan because they realized Omar Bashir is gone, but now the greatest enemy in terms of dictatorship hanging on to power undemocratically has been the military. They are already on the ground organizing and facilitating and overseeing the protest. And these are the people right now whom the military is focusing on in terms of abduction, in terms of detaining them without even any form of trial.
Sudan's military ruler, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, confirmed meetings between Sudanese and Israeli regime officials, claiming they were for security cooperation, not politics. Sudanese masses and political parties have already rejected the military regime's decision to normalize relations with the Israeli regime.
When we talk about the normalization deal with Israel, I think it was a big mistake that will stoke division in Sudan. Many parties in the transitional government have rejected this deal. It will be rejected by the Sudanese people as well. It was a personal decision by members of the government like Burhan and Hamdok. This deal will be resisted by other parties and by the Sudanese people themselves.
Is the Sudanese military leadership increasing its brutal crackdown on civilians due to support by some Western powers and the Israeli regime?
When it comes to global engagement, we have seen a lot of countries, US, Britain, UK as well, talking about, we want return to civilian leadership in Sudan. And therefore, this is not the time some countries to begin to, you know, take these guys very lightly and friendly. No, it's time to say no civilian government, no engagement. And therefore, that's where things go wrong. When it comes to some countries are pro the military junta, others are not. It won't work for the Sudanese people. And I say most of the time when you imagine yourself living in a country since independence, there's never been democratic rule. It's all coups and stuff. No, it's not the way to go. The way to go is let the Sudanese people, civilian leadership, have the prominence, focus, be the thing that everybody wants.
Sudan's strategic location and its resources, especially oil and vast agricultural land, have made it attractive to imperialist powers meddling in the region, especially the United States and the Israeli regime. Now, these imperialist powers have long-term interests in weakening the Republic of Sudan, and this was actually the reason they encouraged South Sudan to break away in 2011. Now, foreign powers have for a long time been interfering in Sudan, and this has exacerbated the crisis in this country. Now, in your opinion, what's the reason for this meddling?
Sudan is an amazing country, you know, technically, because of civil war, it broke into the Sudan and, of course, South Sudan. And the international community, different countries have employed different measures to be the ones who benefit. I'll give you an example. During when United Nations gave arms embargo, which means no country was supposed to sell arms to the Sudanese government in Khartoum, China was still against the UN embargo, selling arms to the government in Khartoum. Yet again, the same country, China, was also brokering deals of oil production within South Sudan. So in South Sudan, they are brokering deals of oil production. In the north, they are selling arms. And when you challenge them, they say, it's just business. Business, arms are for sale. Okay, oil, yeah, it's business. We have agreements, we have contracts. You have all these international players. Most of the time, it happens to be focus on resources rather than stability of that country and the sovereignty of that country. So it's still the same ploy when you look into any other different international community in different countries. Most of these countries are there for themselves rather than for the individual Sudanese people.
While announcing his resignation early January, Sudan's Prime Minister Abdallah Hamdok said the country was at a dangerous turning point threatening its survival. For several years, massive anti-government demonstrations have been taking place in Sudan, mostly over economy. The protesters, youth for a large part, demanded the resignation of then-President Omar al-Bashir. A demonstrator who took part in those protests says,
they will not relent until their demands are met.
I took part in the 2013, 2016 and 2018 protests against Bashir. And here I am now and will continue to protest until our demands are met. I will keep protesting until there is a civilian government and there is peace, freedom and justice.
Now that clearly shows the firm resolve and determination of the Sudanese people in attaining their rights. Mr. Mbaluto, do you think the Sudanese military will eventually give in to the demands of the masses?
With the sustained protests going on, with the lack of relenting within the protesters' fraternity and leadership, it's not giving up, I think, and also lack of a lot of endorsement by this military junta over there in Sudan, it's like a setup whereby you'll never go forever. Not quite. Because at some point, you just realize, oh, you can't continue. You cannot keep this going. I believe AU as well, Africa Union, will be very, you know, keen to see that civilian leadership comes back to Sudan. So when you look into the future, I don't see the military having a greater future there. But the challenge is to send military to facilitate change in Sudan.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mbaluto, for your time. It's been great having you. Now, and as our guest said, the main challenge in Sudan remains the unwillingness of the military to facilitate transition to civilian rule. Now, we shall keep our eyes on Sudan and give you up-to-date analysis. Now that brings us to the end of yet another edition of Africa Today. Drop us a line through our social media handle and let us know your opinion. It was great having you, and goodbye for now.
This is Foresight. A program on how to worship Allah.
Allah, 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 Allah.
Today's great tip, our ubudiyah, our servitude to Allah, and overlooking the self in order to see the divine.
Allah, Allah, Allahu Rabbi, la sharika lahu.
So dear listeners, we're talking about ubudiyah, we're talking about the servitude to Allah, we're talking about the worship of Allah, and we're talking about the obedience to Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted, the Creator and the Sustainer. Now, one of the things that we are taught by the spiritual masters, the urafa, if you will, they teach us that we will have to overlook the self if we want to see the divine. If all of our attention is towards the self, myself, me, I, then how will we ever be able to see the divine? How will we ever be able to feel Allah, to recognize Allah, to really feel the presence of Allah? And so we are taught in order to increase, enhance, strengthen our ubudiyah, our servitude to Allah, that the salik, the spiritual wayfarer, must overlook their own behaviors and their own manners.
And as Imam Khomeini says, they must be completely submitted to the kingdom of the existence of Allah. And so what happens is that you leave the house, this heart, this soul, to its real owner, who is Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted. And eventually one becomes perished in the glory of Allah's lordship. And the owner of the house, the owner of this body and this mind and this soul, himself begins to manage the affairs of that which he owns. And so very quickly, just to try to explain this, because it is quite profound, it is quite deep, and it is quite complex as well. Here we overlook our own behaviors. So what does this perhaps mean? When we overlook our own behaviors and our own preferences, we have to put this into context with what are we focusing on when we are overlooking these. Make sense? So it can't be that we are overlooking all behaviors and all manners, because then we aren't going to do anything.
IRIB English Radio.
Our website is parstoday.com. Dear listeners of the program Foresight, my name is Muhammad. Today, I'm going to read to you an excerpt from Munajat al-Muftariqin, meaning the whispered prayer of the utterly poor. Stay tuned. نهاري دونكم ليل وليلي كله In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. My God, O utmost hope of the hopers, O ultimate demand of the askers, O furthest request of the requesters, O highest desire of the desirers, O patron of the righteous, O security of the fearful, O responder to the supplication of the distressed, O storehouse of the destitute, O treasure of the pitiful, O help of the help seekers, O accomplisher of the needs of the poor and the miserable, O most generous of the most generous, O most merciful of the merciful, to you is my humble subjection and request, to you my pleading and imploring. I ask you to let me attain the repose of your good pleasure, and to make constant toward me the favors of your kindness. Here I am, standing before the gate of your generosity, opening myself up to the breezes of your goodness, holding fast to your strong cord, clinging to your firm handle.
يحيى إذا زرتم وتفرح باللقاء الحدق فإن غبتم فلا صبر ولا جرد ولا رمق بكم
يحيى إذا زرتم وتفرح باللقاء الحدق فإن غبتم فلا صبر ولا جلد ولا رمق.
So what is being said is that we overlook our own personal behaviors, our own personal manners, and we focus on those behaviors and those manners which Allah the Almighty has commanded us to do, right? So for example, whether it's speaking the truth, likewise not lying, being humble, being kind to others, helping the needy, praying our prayers, our salah, our namaz, right? So these are all the behaviors and manners that Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted, the Creator, the Sustainer, has told us to undertake. Now, there are times where we might not feel like giving somebody money, or we might not feel like helping somebody for whatever, you know, petty reason. In these situations, we should overlook our behavior and completely submit to the kingdom of the existence of Allah. Do that which Allah wants us to do. And when we do this, we leave our heart and our mind and our body, we leave it with Allah, who is in reality the original owner of these. And slowly, but perhaps surely even, with time and practice and consistency and motivation and determination, an individual can reach a point where their eyes become divine and they see with the eyes of Al-Haq, meaning Allah. And their ears become divine and they hear with the ears of Al-Haq, Allah. And we see this very clearly in the divine messengers and in the divine infallible imams, these individuals who were, as said, infallible, they committed no sin, whether large or small, knowingly or unknowingly. And they reached a level where they are known as Yadhullah, the hand of Allah, or Saifullah, the sword of Allah, or Asadullah, the lion of Allah. All based upon this idea of overlooking the self in order to see the divine.
IRIB English Radio.
Our website is parstoday.com.
أجب دعائي يا رجائي بالرضا والخير أنر طريقي مع صديقي باحترام الغير.
And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Nami Farhat Al-Amali.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. A lot of youth are turning to religion, but some of them become very extreme. They start interpreting verses and narrations and coming up with their own theories that are not based on any solid evidence, but rather on their weak understanding of religion. And the moment you disagree with them, they start attacking you. This is a problem. But it is never too late to change. What you need to do before you start memorizing information is to work on your spirituality, to clean yourself through losing your ego. Reading is very important, but it's not enough. It is like you have a cup of water in front of you. You read how tasty the water is, how pure it is. Reading can give you some information about the water, but it doesn't make you taste the water. When you work on your spirituality, when you work on cleaning yourself and destroying your ego, you will get a chance to taste how pure the water is. And when this water goes down into your heart, it will remove extremism and it will fill your heart with love to everyone. It will make you accept everyone, even those who you disagree with. It will make you open up to everyone, to love good for everyone, because religion is nothing other than love. Lose your ego to win yourself. Understand that you are nothing to receive everything. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
IRIB English Radio. Our website, www.parstoday.com.
Welcome back, dear listeners. This is Foresight on IRIB English Radio. So continuing what we were saying, of course, which was this idea of in our ubudiyya, in our servitude of Allah, and our servitude to Allah, and our obedience to Allah, that we must overlook the self if we want to see the divine. And so we just talked about in the previous segment, of course, how it's so important that we overlook our own personal, private, and most likely biased and prejudiced manners and behaviors, overlook these, sacrifice these in order to submit ourselves entirely to the Almighty Allah and to do those behaviors and those manners which the Almighty Allah has requested and commanded us to do. Now, another one of the things which falls under this category of overlooking the self is that we have to remove ourselves from being among the veils of this world, the hijabat, the veils, the curtains, the barriers that this materialistic world creates. And so as long as we are enwrapped in the veils and the hijabat of this world, and we live within the covers of nature, within the limitations of physicalityness and materialistness, we cannot have the knowledge of the other world. And thus, we will not be able to keep warm by a remote fire. So, of course, here we have to understand that knowledge of the other world, knowledge of the actions that we do in this world, the knowledge of the relationship between this world and the next world, the knowledge of what our purpose in this life and our purpose of life really is. This knowledge is the source of life, and it is the source of eternity, and it is the source of our human perfection. But if we become enwrapped in the veils of materialism and consumerism and capitalism and even communism and these kind of different things, if we become enwrapped in the veils of the material world, wealth, money, power, glory, etc., then we will not be able to acquire that knowledge which is beneficial to us both in this world and the next. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Foresight. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode and another great tip, fi amanillah, and God bless you all. هو أنسي وملاذي أحتمي بحماه.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Much of the Western mainstream media coverage of the ongoing crisis in Ukraine has displayed once again the blatant white supremacism that is still present in the Euro-American outlook onto the rest of the world. The article you're about to hear has been written by Denijal Djedjic, a writer and researcher currently based in Beirut, Lebanon. He holds a PhD in American Studies. The article is titled Blatant Orientalism in Western Media Coverage of Ukraine War, and the article has been taken from Press TV's website. Much of the Western mainstream media's coverage of the ongoing crisis in Ukraine has displayed once again the blatant white supremacism that is still present in the Euro-American outlook onto the rest of the world. As many Ukrainians are forced to flee their homes as a result of the Russian intervention in Ukraine, the political and media discourse around refugees has at times been inherently racist. Numerous white Western journalists and media personalities could not hold back their outburst of Orientalism and white supremacy when reporting on the situation in Ukraine. The idea that a war could happen in civilized Europe surprised many pundits. Of course, Europe, which has caused both world wars, has waged its many colonial and imperialist wars mostly in the Third World. Besides the fact that war in Ukraine has been ongoing since 2014 and that an actual genocide took place in the 1990s in the cruel wars in Yugoslavia, the underlying assumption now was that because of Europe's alleged supremacy, the idea of war was only imaginable elsewhere in the uncivilized parts of the world. In fact, some of the current media coverage reproduces the Orientalist contrast between the civilized white Christian West and the uncivilized rest of the world. The British newspaper The Daily Telegraph published an article by Daniel Hanan in which the author referred to Russia's actions as an attack on civilization itself. They, the author argued, referring to Ukrainians, seem so like us, that is what makes it so shocking. Stating that Ukraine is a European country, the author opposes its people who watch Netflix and have Instagram accounts to impoverished and remote populations. Reporting from Kiev, CBS News correspondent Charlie Degatta claims Ukraine is not a place with all due respect like Iraq or Afghanistan, but rather relatively civilized, relatively European. Speaking to the BBC, Ukraine's former deputy general prosecutor David Sakvaridze said, "It's very emotional for me because I see European people with blonde hair and blue eyes being killed every day with Putin's missiles and his helicopters and his rockets." His remarks remained unchallenged by the broadcaster, the BBC. These are but examples of the double standard and racist creation of difference. The rhetoric is based on the assumption that war is a natural circumstance outside of the allegedly superior European-American sphere and that non-white people, that is the vast majority of the world's population, engage in wars because they are not civilized, not because of colonial and imperialist wars. This perspective also reveals how comfortably unaffected these media personalities must have been by all the wars launched against people in the Third World. White supremacy is the fundamental of European-American civilization. the Orientalist division of human beings into desirable and undesirable people, has been structurally inscribed in dominant media discourse. The discourse around civilization not only reinforces Europe's violent racial hierarchies, but also explicitly normalizes warfare against people who do not look like the white, blue-eyed, blonde-haired European.